Okay.
I didn't ask for that, by the way. Just so it'll be clear. Reminds me of a joke that they used to tell about Lyndon Johnson. He was once introduced in a very effusive way, and his response was, "You know, my father would have found that introduction very interesting, but only my mother would have believed it." In any event, tonight I'd like to tell you a little bit about my experiences hunting Nazis. And whenever I tell anybody about my job, which, as you can imagine, is not exactly the run-of-the-mill profession, so there are usually two responses. One response is, what, are there still Nazis to bring to justice? And the second response is, how do you do it? What does a Nazi hunter do? And how did you become a Nazi hunter? And very often people will come to me and say, and very often it's children of survivors or grandchildren of survivors, they'll say that that was their dream when they were growing up, to be a Nazi hunter, to catch those Nazis and torture them and kill them and all sorts of other good things to do to them. But the irony of the story is that that was never my fantasy. My fantasy growing up in Brooklyn, as you can hear from my wonderful Brooklyn accent, was actually to be the first Orthodox Jew to play in the NBA. However, to be perfectly honest, okay, I wasn't good enough, and you really can't be an Orthodox Jew in the NBA, so basketball's loss is Nazi hunting's gain. Apropos the first question, it's very ironic because tomorrow in Münster, in Germany, the trial will open of a Stutthof guard. Stutthof was a camp right near Gdansk where 65,000 people were murdered, not only Jews, also Poles. And the person in question was a guard in that camp. And this trial is actually a result of a very dramatic change in German prosecution policy, which is quite amazing and has made it much easier to bring to justice Nazi war criminals. Until 10 years ago, in order to prosecute a Nazi war criminal in Germany, you had to prove that that person had committed a specific crime against the specific victim and had done so motivated by racial hatred. It's almost impossible to prove. But ironically, it was the case of Ivan Demjanjuk, I don't know how many of you remember him, which created a very dramatic change. And basically what happened was the following. Demjanjuk, as many of you might remember, was Ukrainian, was living in Cleveland, and he had been identified as Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Terrible, one of the two Ukrainians who ran the gas chambers at Treblinka. Now, as you know, in the United States, you cannot prosecute the Nazi war criminals for the crimes that they committed because the crimes were committed outside the United States and the victims were not Americans. So the Americans were confronted by a very serious legal dilemma because the choice was either to try and change the Constitution, which is, as you can imagine, is very difficult, or to let these people live out their lives in peace and tranquility. So the U.S. adopted what I call the Al Capone Compromise. You all know what happened to Al Capone, I assume, right? Instead of trying him for murder and racketeering, he was tried for income tax, and they were able to, you know, jail him. So it's more or less the same in this case. These people were not tried for the crimes. They were tried for lying on their immigration applications and later when they became citizens. The punishment was denaturalization, losing their citizenship, and then they would be kicked out of the United States. If there were a country that was willing to extradite them, that would take precedence. In any event, Demjanjuk was initially denaturalized, stripped of his citizenship, and the Americans realized, listen, this is probably one of the biggest mass murders, if not the biggest mass murder in human history. In other words, 875,000 Jews were murdered in Treblinka. This is the guy who, together with his partner, ran the gas chambers. So it would be absurd just to let him go run away somewhere. So they convinced Israel to take him. Some of the witnesses against him were actually from Israel. He was sent to Israel. He was extradited to Israel, put on trial, convicted, sentenced to death. And in Israel, you have to appeal a death sentence. In other words, even if you don't want to. And in the course of that appeal, it emerged that a mistake had been made. Because the Israeli prosecution, not the defense attorneys, the Israeli prosecutors found the testimony of 30 Vachman, that's armed SS guards, Ukrainians, who had been tried in Kiev, who testified that Ivan Grozny had a very prominent scar on his cheek, which Demjanjuk did not have. So it was obvious that Demjanjuk was not the Ivan Grozny, the Ivan the Terrible of Treblinka. It was clear that he was a Nazi war criminal. He had also been in Sobibor. He had been in Majdanek. But Israel expelled him after convicting him of membership in a Nazi organization. He came back to the States, again got his citizenship, but to the credit of the U.S. government, they then brought him up on charges of service in Sobibor. He was denaturalized. He was ordered deported either to Ukraine, Poland, or Germany. But the problem was that none of these countries were willing to take him. Ukraine didn't want him because from their perspective, he's a hero. Okay, Ukraine has the worst record in the world in terms of prosecuting Nazi war criminals. They have never launched even a single investigation of a Nazi war criminal, let alone prosecution, since they became independent. Poland was willing to bring him to justice, but the problem was there were no witnesses who remembered or could identify Demjanjuk. None. Germany didn't want him because he wasn't a German or a Volksdeutscher, someone of German origin. And it looked as if Demjanjuk would finish his life, his miserable life, in Seven Hills in Cleveland. But the Americans were determined to get rid of him, and they appealed to Germany to find a way to bring him to justice. And two righteous Gentiles, wonderful, wonderful lawyers who worked at the Central Office for the Clarification of Nazi War Crimes in Ludwigsburg in Germany, came up with a strategy. Thomas Walter, Kirsten Getzer, proposed the following change. Since the primary purpose of the death camps was to murder innocent civilians, any person who served in a death camp, now by death camp we mean not any concentration camp, but only those concentration camps with the apparatus for industrialized mass murder. Six existed, they were all in Poland. The largest was Auschwitz, then Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor, Chełmno, and Majdanek. So, since their primary purpose was mass murder of innocent civilians, anyone who had served in those camps in any capacity could be convicted, not for murder, but for accessory to murder. And the punishment for that was 5 to 15 years. And given the age of these people, it's basically a life sentence. So Demjanjuk was the first, you could say, guinea pig. He was the first person tried under this new strategy. He was convicted in May of 2011. And the minute he was convicted, the German authorities started looking for anybody who had served in the death camps who had not been brought to justice. Now, in that summer, I went to meet the heads of this office. And I said to them, you know, I congratulated them on the achievement, very important, but you know, you could apply the same reasoning also to the Einsatzgruppen. The Einsatzgruppen were the mobile killing units, A, B, C, and D, which murdered 1.5 million Jews in the areas of the Soviet Union from June 1941 till the end of 43. They said, of course, that's correct, and we're already operating on that basis. Wonderful. As time went by, however, every so often, this office used to announce that they had found X number of people from Majdanek, X number of people from Auschwitz, and not a single word about anybody from the Einsatzgruppen. And this, to me, seemed, I have to say, seemed very strange. We assumed that there were at least 3,000 people who had served in the Einsatzgruppen. And I said to myself, you know, every single one of these people is already dead. They live in Germany. They have good medical service there. People without a conscience live longer. You know, there's got to be someone who's alive. And it would be super important to have a trial of people from the Einsatzgruppen. So I had the names and dates of birth in my files for a completely different project of 1,069 people who served in A, B, C, and D, in the Einsatzgruppen A, B, C, and D. And I made a list of all the people who'd been born 1920 or later. Okay, that was, it's an arbitrary date, but you would, it's a fair assumption that anyone born before that is already dead. I found 80 people, 76 men, 4 women. And I sent that list to the German authorities. It took a year and a half until they got back to me, and they said that 8 cases on this list are of interest to them. In other words, that means that they might be alive. do I have any more information? So in some cases, I had more information. I sent it to the authorities, and weeks go by. I'm waiting. I don't know if you ever worked opposite bureaucracies. Bureaucracies love to take information, and or governments love to take information. They never give you any information. In any event, I was getting quite frustrated. So basically what I did was I teamed up with German television, Channel 1, ARD, and they have a program, the equivalent of 60 Minutes, investigative program. I gave them the names. They found and interviewed two people alive who had been in Einsatzgruppe C. They're the people who carried out the murders in Babi Yar, the largest massacre in the history of the Shoah. September 29th, 30th, 1941, 33,771, almost all Jews, a couple of other enemies of the Reich, murdered outside Kiev. And then a third one was found by the government. Now, all these people are now in pretrial investigation. And believe me, I am praying very, very hard for their good health. I'm serious. I'm the only Jew in the world who prays for the good health of Nazis. But you have to understand, obviously, only the ones who can be brought to justice. Now, I just 3 weeks ago gave a new list. We continued our project. A new list of 143 people who were born, served in the Einsatzgruppen, and born 1920 and later. And apparently, we already found one, another one, and hopefully we'll find more. But this is just to give you a little insight, a little indication that the fight goes on. The trial starts. One trial starts tomorrow. There are another bunch of indictments already submitted by the Germans against other people's guards who served in concentration camps. And it's not over yet. I can assure you that we at the Wiesenthal Center will do everything in our power to be able to bring as many of these people as possible to justice as long as it's possible. Now, let's go back to the second question. In other words, how did I become a Nazi hunter? So I'll tell you three stories, which I hope will give you sort of indication, understanding, insight into how this whole thing works. First story is about someone you all know about, the infamous angel of death of Auschwitz, Dr. Josef Mengele. In 1985, the Simon Wiesenthal Center sent a letter to the National Archives in Washington for any and all information regarding Josef Mengele. Josef Mengele had basically disappeared into thin air. No one knew where he was. Okay? Now, one of the letters that the Wiesenthal Center, one of the documents the Wiesenthal Center received was absolutely shocking. It was a letter from a counterintelligence officer of the U.S. Army who wrote to his superior, January 1947, that according to an informant, the United States Army had arrested and released Dr. Josef Mengele near Vienna in late 1946. Now, this was absolutely shocking. The Americans had let him go. They had him. They let him go. What a mess. Anyway, so the Wiesenthal Center is very good at making scandals, I have to say. I wasn't working there at the time. They know how to do it on their own, believe me. And they made a gigantic scandal out of this, and the American government made three decisions. One is the U.S. government will begin to look, physically look for Josef Mengele. Two, they'll check whether Josef Mengele ever entered the United States as a refugee, because at this point, the Americans already knew that thousands of Nazi war criminals had come to the United States posing as innocent refugees. Third, an investigation will be conducted by the Office of Special Investigations. That's the office set up in 1979 to bring Nazi war criminals to justice. That's the office I was working for in Israel as a researcher. I worked there for 6 years, in Israel for 6 years for them. And they would determine whether or not it was true that Mengele had been arrested and released. Okay, now. My assignment was to find the informant. The informant was a man named David Freiman, who was a Jew from the Lodz ghetto, who was among the last Jews deported to Auschwitz. This is in September of 1944, and he was sent to work in Mengele's clinic. So he knew Mengele. He saw him on a daily basis, and it was he who contacted this counterintelligence officer, actually a Jew from Palestine, named Benjamin Gorby, Goldstein, and how do you find them? It's 41 years later. This is already 1986. How do you find someone like that? So a colleague of mine, David Silberklang, suggested that I look in the files of something called the International Tracing Service. Now, I don't know if any of you have heard of it. About 4 years ago, they finally granted access to this. But until then, okay, first of all, I have to explain. What was this collection? The International Red Cross was deluged with millions of requests for information after World War II about people who had lived in Europe. What happened to my grandfather? What happened to my cousin? What happened to my uncle? Now, in those days, there were no databases. So basically, they compiled an enormous collection of over 16 million index cards. Now, it's not 16 million people because some people had more than one card. But it's millions and millions of people who were in Europe during the war. Now, there was no indication on these cards that any of these people had been Nazi war criminals. But I had my own sources for that. But the amazing thing was, first of all, I always thought that this material is in Yad Vashem because it's all Jews. Well, guess what? It was mostly non-Jews. And on these cards, they had the immigration destinations of those people who emigrated outside of Europe. Now, I knew from my experience researching Nazi war criminals that almost every Nazi war criminal who ran away to an Anglo-Saxon country had registered in a DP camp to get privileges as a refugee. And here was the information where they went to. Now, I mean, it was like a real eureka moment. It almost seemed too good to be true. So I made a little experiment. I took the names of 49 Lithuanians and Latvians that I knew were Nazi war criminals, and I went looking for them. In a matter of minutes, I found 16 of them. Most of them went to America, some went to Australia, two to Canada, some remained in Germany. And this was really an unbelievable tool now to be used. Now, but I have to add one thing that I didn't mention. This material was, there was no access to this material anywhere except in Israel. In other words, if I had written to the people in Arilson, that's in Germany, that's where the original was, and say, I'm looking for information on my uncle, they would have answered me maybe 6 months, 9 months later. If I would have written to them and said, listen, I'm a researcher for the Office of Special Investigations or the reasons or whatever, they wouldn't have even answered me. Now, the material was in the hands of 11 different countries, okay? The only country where you could get to it was Israel at Yad Vashem. Now, at this point in time, the only country of the Anglo-Saxon countries which had already made a decision to take legal action against the Nazis who would come as refugees, posing as refugees, was the United States, okay? Canada was investigating. Australia was investigating. Britain and New Zealand didn't even know that they had a problem, or they didn't want to know that they had a problem, okay? So I said to myself, you know, this is really a historic moment. We have to find a way to convince these countries that they have to take legal action. They can't ignore the fact that hundreds and thousands of these collaborators of Hitler, some of the worst of Hitler's henchmen, had come to these countries posing as innocent refugees and were allowed in, rebuilt their lives, and it was an absolute travesty of justice. Now, I couldn't do anything while I was working for the Americans because they were interested only in the cases in the United States. So I called up Rabbi Haya at the Wiesenthal Center, where I had worked for 2 years initially in 78 to 80, and I said, listen, this is our opportunity. The best way to convince these countries that they have to take legal action is to flood them with the names of suspects. It's one thing if they have a couple of cases, 5, 10 cases that they know about, and they're trying to decide what to do. But if they have 200 cases, 300 cases, 400 cases, then they can't actually turn us down. And that's what we did. And Rabbi Haya set up an office in Jerusalem, and I started churning out the lists. The first list was 40 names to Australia, then 17 names to Britain, then 26 names to Canada. And over the years, it was thousands and thousands of names of suspects to these countries. And the good news was that Canada in 1987, Australia in 1989, Great Britain in 1991, all passed special laws to enable criminal prosecution of Nazi war criminals. So that's, you could say that that's basically what turned me from a researcher into a Nazi hunter. Okay, now, you're all wondering about Mengele, of course, right? Or you should be wondering about Mengele. In any event, once the Americans started looking for him, Israel and Germany joined in the search, and finally, a man named Hans Seidelmeier, had his office. He was a very high official in the company of the Mengele family in Gunzburg, Bavaria. And his office was raided, and they discovered the a correspondence between Joseph Mengele and his family. And it turned out that Joseph Mengele had drowned swimming in the ocean, in Atlantic Ocean, and he died of a stroke, was buried in a place called Embu, E-M-B-U, near Sao Paulo, and we blew it, basically. Everyone blew it. And I often ask myself the following question. Why didn't they look for Mengele in 1975 or 1965? Why wasn't he caught? Imagine what an important trial it would have been. Trial about the perversion of science, the violation of the Hippocratic Oath, a symbol of Nazi evil. Okay? And the answer is lack of political will. That was the problem. And that's a problem that has continued to plague this effort from the day the war ended to this very day. And part of my job really is not only to find Nazis and to find documents to build a case against Nazis, but to lobby to create political will where there's no political will to bring these people to justice. Okay, second story. The most important Nazi war criminal, at least one of the most important Nazi war criminals that I helped bring to justice was the last living concentration camp commander, a man named Dinko Šakić, whom you've probably never heard of, but he was the commandant, one of the commandants, of the worst camp in the Balkans, a camp named Jasenovac. Now, just a little history. April of 41, the Nazis and Italians invade Yugoslavia, take over the country, cut it up into a number of different pieces, one of which was the independent state of Croatia. Now, this independent state of Croatia had never existed before for 1,000 years, and they handed it on a silver platter to a fascist movement called Ustasha. I don't know if any of you have heard of him. A movement founded in the 20s. Basically, the goal was to separate Croatia, make Croatia an independent state, get it away from the Serbs, away from Yugoslavia. Notoriously anti-Serb, anti-Semitic, anti-Gypsy, anti-anyone who disagreed with them. Now, the independent state of Croatia existed of what's today Croatia, plus Bosnia-Herzegovina, and a slice of Serbia, a small piece of Serbia. And the problem from the viewpoint of the Ustasha was that it was full of the minorities that they hated. Hundreds of thousands of Serbs, 40,000 Jews, several thousand Roma. And they set up concentration camps all over the country to which these people, they started deporting these people, many of whom were murdered. Now, there's a big debate about Jasenovac, between the Croats and the Serbs. You ask any Serb, how many Serbs were killed, how many people were killed in Jasenovac, will say 700,000. Ask any Croatian, will say barely 50,000. And it's going on to this day. And there's still enormous tension. If you want to understand the wars of Yugoslavia in the 90s, it started then, in World War II. It didn't start in the 90s. Okay? In any event, we say at least 100,000. Now, Dinko Šakić was one of the commanders. The camp was notorious for the cruelty of the guards, terror, executions. I mean, the place was nicknamed the Auschwitz of the Balkans. No gas chambers, no gas vans, individual murders. One by one, by grenades, rifles, daggers, swords, bullets, you name it. In any event, a lot of the Ustasha were able to escape from Europe after World War II, because the number two person in what we call the rat lines, the escape networks of the Nazi war criminals, was an Ustasha priest named Kronoslav Dragonovich. So it was no surprise that a man like Ante Pavelić, Ante Pavelić was the head of state in the independent state of Croatia, one of the biggest mass murderers in the history of World War II, was able to escape to Buenos Aires. Dinko Šakić, one of the commanders of Jasenovac, also escaped to Argentina. And we were able to find him more than 50 years after the war, living in a place called Santa Teresita, 250 miles south of Buenos Aires. We worked with an Argentinian journalist named Jorge Camarasa, and we sent him to Yugoslavia, to Serbia, to meet survivors of Jasenovac before he went with a TV crew to confront Dinko Šakić. He goes to Šakić's house, he knocks on the door. Šakić comes to the door. Are you Dinko Šakić? Yes. You were the commandant of Jasenovac. Yes. Let's stop there for a minute. Okay, normally, when a Nazi is about to be exposed, there's two answers. One is, it's not me, mistaken identity, or it's me and I didn't do it. What does Dinko Shakic say? It's me and I did it. He then was 76. Okay, now, Kamarasa says, listen, I have a couple questions to ask you. Can we go inside? Yeah, no problem. They sit in Shakic's living room. Kamarasa says to him, you were the commandant of Jasenovac, the worst camp in the Balkans. Hundreds of thousands of people murdered there. What do you have to say for yourself? So Shakic says, what's the problem? Jasenovac was a penal colony, and every country had penal colonies, and every person who was in Jasenovac deserved to be there. So Kamarasa says, listen, you can't fool me. I spoke to the survivors. What about the mass murder? He says, what kind of, Shakic replies, what kind of mass murder? Maybe a couple of people died of typhus. But you don't get it, he says to Kamarasa. You know what the problem with Jasenovac was? They didn't let us finish the job. Now, when did he say this? He didn't say this. It's not 1945, when the camp was closed down in April. It's more than 50 years later. That's Dinko Shakic's conclusion. They didn't let us finish the job. That's the problem. Now, we have a lot of legal problems involved in getting Nazis prosecuted. In this case, there were six different countries which, in theory, could have put Shakic on trial. Argentina, where he lived. Israel, because he had 18,000 Jews murdered in Jasenovac. Germany, they were German allies. And the three Balkan countries, Serbia, Bosnia, and Croatia. The camp itself was in the territory of Serbia and the Bosnia and the Serbian part of Bosnia. But the question we asked ourselves was, who needs the lesson of Jasenovac the most? If we were thinking only result, we definitely would have had him sent to Serbia. Because within 5 minutes after being convicted in Belgrade, he would have been hanging from the highest tree. Okay? But everyone in Serbia knows about Jasenovac. They teach about it in the schools. So many people had relatives who were killed in Jasenovac. So who needs the lesson? Croatia. But there's a problem, because the president of Croatia at this time was none other than Franjo Tudjman, who's the only head of state in the Western world who ever denied the Holocaust. He actually wrote a book called The Wastelands of Historical Reality. He considered himself a historian, in which he said that the Jews inflated the number of victims from 1 million to 6 million. And it was the Jews who ran Jasenovac. Now, this is all very strange, because Tudjman himself fought against the Ustasha. He fought with Tito's partisans. He was a very high-ranking officer. His brother was murdered by the Ustasha. But when he became a Croatian politician, he became an ultra-nationalist. So these are the things that he said. In any event, we gambled. We gambled, and we had him extradited to Croatia. And just to give you a little example of what we were up against, I'll tell you the following story. After Shakic was sitting in jail, he was awaiting the beginning of the trial, the World Cup took place. This is 1998 in France. I don't know if there are any soccer fans here. Anybody? Okay, what happened on the night of July 4th, 1998 in the quarterfinals? The biggest upset in World Cup history. Anybody know? Croatia won. Croatia won 3-0, okay? Anyway, I'm in the middle of the match, I'm walking through the street. I'm walking on the street. All of a sudden, the street shakes. I'm saying, what? What's going on? Is there an earthquake? No. Croatia scored a goal, okay? Then at the end of the match, I walk out to see the celebrations, and within like 3 minutes, I'm standing there with a kippah on my head, and seven young men are walking towards me, waving this gigantic flag, which I couldn't see, is it maybe a Ustasha flag or a Croatian flag, actually quite similar. And they're yelling at the top of their lungs, Dinko Shakic, Dinko Shakic. Dinko Shakic is in jail, awaiting trial for mass murder. He didn't score the goals for Croatia against Germany, right? Why are they yelling his name? Not good luck, because he's a hero. To many Croatians, he's a hero. Anyway, the good news is that the Croatians actually did a good job in terms of the trial. Shakic was convicted. Just to give you a little taste of the testimony, one of the most dramatic testimonies was of a Jewish survivor who at the age of 15 was deported from Sarajevo with other young Jews his age to Jasenovac. A couple of days after they arrive at the camp, the guards take them, all these young boys, and they bring them to a huge pile of body parts. The guards had murdered the inmates, quite a number of inmates, and afterwards had hacked off their arms and legs. And there's this huge pile of body parts at the edge of the camp. And they take these kids and they say to them, okay, you must throw all these body parts now into the Sava River. Sava River runs at the edge of the camp. So Yaakov Finzi, that's his name, Sephardic family, turns to the guard who gave him the order and says, why are you doing this to us? So the guard says, because you murdered Jesus. You want to understand how you get a Yasenovats? You take hundreds of years of Christian anti-Semitism, you add the fascism of the Ustasha, the racism of the Nazis, that's how you get a Yasenovats, with at least 100,000 victims. Anyway, on the day of the verdict, the courtroom was absolutely packed, but the problem was, half the people there, believe it or not, favored Shakich. They were supported Shakich. The other half were against Shakich. So when the judge, Drazen Tripolo, announces the verdict, 20 years in prison, which was the maximum, and he's 78 years old already at this time in the trial, chaos broke loose in the courtroom. It was absolutely mad. People were fighting. People were spitting at us. It was absolutely crazy. On my way out, some guy says to me, why don't you go back to Israel and deal with the Palestinians? In good American English, he said it to me. Just a small example. And then a tall, very nicely dressed gentleman stops me on the way out and says to me, listen, I have only one word to say to you. Okay, in Croatian it's one word. Hvala. Hvala means thank you. Okay? If not for you, this trial never would have taken place. Now, I didn't know who he was, but I asked someone, I said, who is this guy who stopped me? And he said, and he told me the following. Another one of the dramatic stories in the course of the trial was that one day in April 44, there was a breach of discipline by the inmates of Jasenovac. And Shakich immediately calls a roll call. Everyone has to appear at the center square of Jasenovac and line up in lines. And he's walking up and down the line and totally at random taking people out who will be hung in reprisal for the breach of discipline. And one of the people he pointed to and took him out of the line was a doctor from Montenegro, non-Jew, by the name of Dr. Miller Boshkovitz. And Miller Boshkovitz says to him, I'm from Montenegro, and my tradition doesn't allow me to be hung. Shakich, on the spot, takes his pistol out, shoots him in the head, murders him. The person who stopped me was his brother. And I can promise you that his brother never believed in a million years that one day Croatia will be a democratic country, and they'll put this uber patriot, Dinko Shakic, on trial, and they'll sentence him to the maximum sentence. Now, this is one of the things that Simon Wiesenthal always taught us. It's very important. Justice is very important in general, but justice is particularly important for the victims and their families. They deserve some degree of closure. I'm sure that the brother Miller Boshkovitz never believed that he would get any closure, but it happened. And believe me, when I get into these frustrating situations, when people die on me in the middle of an investigation, die on me before they go to trial or before an appeal, and this happens, it's an occupational hazard. You know, it happens all the time. I think back to Miller Boshkovitz's brother and what it meant for him and what all this work means for the families of the victims. Now, last story. He died in jail. He died in jail, but I have to tell you something. It wasn't a pretty end, because he had a private funeral. He asked to be buried in his Ustasha uniform. In other words, if you were wondering, maybe he saw the light, forget it. Okay? And as a matter of fact, one important thing I have to tell you, you know, sometimes people say to me, Dr. Zuroff, so many years have passed since the end of the war, these people are probably sorry about what they did. Okay, one second. I want to strengthen the question. Okay, think of how much information there is now in the last 15, 20 years about the Shoah. Okay, books, theater, movies, not to mention the internet, you name it. So in theory, these people could have read that material, or their grandchildren could have asked them questions, etc. And they could have said to themselves, you know what, that Shoah, that Holocaust everyone's talking about, that's what we did. We were involved in it. But we were stupid, we were young, we were brainwashed, we were convinced the Jew was the enemy. We made a mistake. Possible? In theory?
In theory.
Okay, it's never happened. Rest assured. In other words, the cases that I've dealt with, cases from all over Europe, and people who ran away to all over the world, from Australia to Lithuania, from Chile to Iceland, never had a single case of any Nazi who ever expressed remorse or regret. Okay, now, one last story about the process, okay? We have a very serious obstacle. We can't work like the police. The natural way to work to find criminals is to start with a crime and then try and determine who committed that crime, okay? But since 99% of the people who committed the crimes of the Shoah are already dead, we can't work that way. We have to work based on tips about people who are alive, healthy enough to be brought to justice, who may or may not be a Nazi war criminal. Now, we're offering money. We have this thing called Operation Last Chance, the Wiesenthal Center's flagship project in this regard. And because we're offering money, on the one hand, we get a lot of publicity. On the other hand, we get a lot of shtuyot. I mean, we get a lot of stuff that is totally worthless. I'll give you two examples. About 7 years ago, I got an email from someone in Germany who tells me the following story. In 1970, when I was backpacking in Peru, in a place whose name I don't remember, all the locals were talking about the German. Now, what am I supposed to do? He doesn't remember the name of the place. He doesn't know the name of the person. Almost 50 years have passed. What do I do? Get on my private jet and go find the guy. Okay. But there's another type of call. It's even crazier, stupider. And this is only from America. Okay? Someone calls from America. Is this the Wiesenthal Center? Yes. Are you still hunting Nazis? Yes. 1 second. Sometimes they also ask, are you still offering money? Yes, we're still offering money. Well, I want to tell you that last week I had this terrible fight with my 92-year-old neighbor who's a German who must be a Nazi. Okay, let me give you a real case, okay? One day I get a email from a guy living in Scotland, says that he has a Hungarian girlfriend, and the Hungarians in Scotland gather for social events, to which an elderly Hungarian named Stephen Brandon comes and brags that he was involved in the deportation of Jews to Auschwitz in the spring and summer of 1944. This guy is writing to me. This guy's non-Jew. I'm absolutely disgusted by this. Maybe someone over there could do the research and shut this guy up. I swear to God, that was the email. So right away, I write to this guy, thank him for contacting us. I say, but listen, you know, Stephen Brandon is not a Hungarian name. And unless we can find his real name, we'll never know if he really was involved. Right away, he wrote me back, you're right. His name's István Bojdosó. That's a Hungarian name, trust me. It's a Hungarian name, okay? And he's a master sergeant of the gendarmerie, which also fits perfectly because it was the Hungarian gendarmerie. It's like half military, half police, who rounded up 437,000 Hungarian Jews in the spring and summer of 1944 and sent them to Auschwitz. Okay, so we have to go see if we can find anything. I don't know Hungarian, unfortunately, and I worked together with Dr. Bar Shaked in Yad Vashem, he's from Hungary, a researcher, historian, and he's looking, I can't find anything. No sign of Master Sergeant István Bojdosó. Okay. One of our problems was, of course, that we didn't know where he was, okay? In any event, a couple of months later, a journalist from Scotland came to interview me for a feature of the Glasgow Sunday Magazine, the Glasgow Herald. And this guy, his name was Michael Turner, he made a very good impression on me. And I said, this guy could probably help me. So I told him the following. Listen, Michael, I have this case in Scotland of Hungarian, but I don't know where he was. So what I want you to do is this. Call up this István Bojdosó. Tell him that the Glasgow Herald wants to do a full-color feature in the Sunday magazine on Hungarians in Scotland. That's an important subject, no? Hungarians in Scotland? He will invite you to his house. I'll tell you in a minute how I knew that. He will invite you to his house, and you interview him as if you're really doing this story. And in the middle of the interview, you sort of put in a question. By the way, Mr. Boydeshaw, where were you in the spring and summer of 1944? Okay, took a while until it happened. But Michael Turney writes me, listen, Ephraim, there's good news and there's better news. I couldn't imagine what it could be, but okay, I call him up. All right, so what's the story? Okay, listen, the good news is that Boydeshaw is from Miskolc. Miskolc was the sixth largest city in Hungary, 12,000 or 14,000 Jews, deported in the middle of June 1944. Yofi, okay. But what's the better news? He says, listen to this, you're not going to believe it. On the wall in Boydeshaw's house is a photograph of a high-ranking gendarmerie officer. So it's obviously not Boydeshaw, he's only a master sergeant. So I asked Boydeshaw, who is this guy on your wall? He says, oh, that's Chandor Kapiro. He's a much higher officer than me, and we're in contact all the time. Wonderful, right? By the way, how did I know that he would invite him to his house? Because Boydeshaw had built a monument in his backyard to mark the 150th anniversary of the visit to Scotland of Lajos Kossuth. Now, I'm assuming no one knows who that is. He was a very important Hungarian nationalist in the revolution of 1848. And, of course, if there's going to be a color feature story on the Hungarians of Scotland, they have to put in a picture of this monument, you understand? And he signed it, István Boydeshaw, Master Sergeant, anyway, of the Gendarmerie. So, of course, that's what happened. Anyway, so there was one piece of information missing about this Kapiro. Where is he? Right? He didn't say where he was. So I told Michael to call up Boydeshaw. Tell him how excited they are in the Glasgow Herald about the story, the upcoming story. And by the way, your friend Kapiro, where is he these days? So he told me he's in Hungary. So I have to be careful. I once made a mistake. I exposed a 92-year-old Croatian who was involved. He was a police chief in Croatia, and he sent hundreds of people to camps of the Ustasha. And to my great amazement, he actually ran away to Austria. And Austria is a paradise for Nazi war criminals. And he never was put on trial. So I have to be careful. And in any event, so we started looking for Boydeshaw Kapiro himself. It wasn't very hard. He's listed in the Budapest phone book. And he lives right opposite a functioning shul in Budapest. Okay. In any event, but I didn't know Kapiro was. To be honest, I had no idea who he was. So the next day I go to Dr. Barshaked, my Hungarian expert, to tell him the good news. Boydeshaw is from Miskolc, and there's this guy Kapiro. Okay, so I tell him about Miskolc, then I mention Kapiro, and the guy goes white. Now, he's a very pious Jew, but Dr. Barshaked, very pious. I'm going to tell you what his response was, first in Hebrew. I'm assuming there's some people here who know Hebrew. And then I'll translate. When he heard Kapiro's name and he's alive, he said, Ma, ha-ben zona hazeh adayin b'chayim? You mean to say that son of a bitch is still alive? Well, it turns out he was alive. So the story was this. Kapiro was a gendarmerie officer. He was one of a group of officers who, in 3 days, from January 21st to January 23rd, 1942, carried out a series of murders in and around the city of Novi Sad in northern Serbia. And basically what happened was that in Novi Sad itself, the city was divided into quarters. There was an officer put in charge of each section, and their job was to round up all the Serbs, all the Jews, and all the Roma, take them to a large building in the middle of a theater in the middle of Novi Sad, where a committee of Hungarian officers would determine whether any of those people should be released. Now, the only people who were released were Hungarians. In other words, if by accident they had arrested Hungarians, they'd be released. All the other people were marched on foot from Sokolsky Dome, that's the theater, to the banks of the Danube. It was minus 30 degrees on that day. The Hungarians brought a cannon. They broke the ice. They lined the people up in lines of four, and they mowed them down row by row until 6 hours later, a light plane lands on the Danube, on the part that wasn't broken on the ice. Two officers get out from Budapest and say, what the hell are you doing? This was not authorized operation. The murders were stopped. I met two survivors, one of them who was there as a four-year-old child who was being held by his father. And he lives in Budapest today. And I said to him, how much time between you and being murdered? He said, 20 minutes. If those officers hadn't landed when they landed, had they come an hour later, I would have been murdered, my parents would have been murdered, and the same for the other, for the second survivor who lives in Rishon, Lydia Brenes. So in any event, that's who Kapiro was. But the interesting part of this case was that those officers had actually been put on trial in Hungary. In December of 1943, they were all put on trial. They were all convicted. Some of them were sentenced to be executed. Others given prison terms, like Kapiro. And unfortunately, before those punishments could be applied, March 19th, 1944, what happened? The Nazis invaded Hungary. Nazis invaded Hungary, and they put pressure on the Hungarians to cancel the convictions, return the people to service. And that's what happened. Now, when I came to the Hungarian prosecutors, they said everyone knew who Kapiro was, everyone knew about the trial. They said if this is war crimes or crimes against humanity, no problem, there's no statute of limitations, we just have to find the verdict and we'll check. Okay, they're looking for the verdict. Every week I call them, no verdict. His file was clean. Someone cleaned out his file, Kapiro's file. I found the verdict in Serbia. First in Serbian, then in Hungarian original. Okay? Then they said, well, then I said to him, listen, apply this original sentence. He was sentenced to 10 years. Just put him in jail for 10 years. He's already 92 years old. He was in good shape, but he's already 92. So just put him in jail for 10 years. No, 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 we can't do it. They started a new investigation. And the thing is dragging on and on and on, and they're playing for time. In the meantime, Kapiro sues me. What did he sue me for? For libel. Now, one second. What's the libel? Two different libels. One is I called him a Nazi. How could I call him a Nazi? He wasn't in the Nazi party. How could I call him a Nazi? But the more important libel was the following. I gave a speech in Budapest on Yom HaShoah, the Holocaust Day, and it's April 19th, the day of the first ghetto in Munkács, in Hungary. And I said that Kapiro is a moral monster of the Holocaust. Now, I have to explain why. On the night before the murders in Novi Sad, the officer gave the instructions of what to do to all the people in charge of the, you know, like Kapiro, he's in charge of a certain section, said, if you encounter any opposition, just shoot. Don't even think twice, just murder the people. So Kapiro, at this point, was 28 years old. He was a lawyer. He had completed his law degree. He knew that that order was illegal. So he said to the officer, I want to see the order in writing. So the officer says, orders like this are only transmitted orally, not in writing. So in other words, Kapiro knows he's a lawyer. He's educated. He's intelligent. He knows the order is illegal. He carries out the order anyway. This is not some illiterate peasant who got brainwashed. This is a guy who's smart, who knows the score, and he does it anyway. So I said he's a moral monster of the Holocaust. Anyway, I had a big dilemma whether or not to go to this trial. On the one hand, I thought the thing, I mean, it's ridiculous, right, on the one hand. On the other hand, if I don't go, they could take out a European arrest warrant against me, and then I can't do anything. I can't go anywhere. Now, but the problem also was that this is a criminal trial, by the way. It's not, in other words, if I lose, it's not only paying compensation to Kapiro, it's 2 years in a Budapest jail. And I don't like goulash, especially non-kosher goulash. No, seriously. So this was a really big dilemma. In the meantime, they're not charging him. So I said to myself, you know, this is the only chance we'll have in a court of law to tell the story of what Kapiro did and why it's important to put him in behind bars. So I went to the trial. I have to say there was one thing that was incredibly dramatic. And I had no idea this was going to happen. The judge all of a sudden asked me, do I have any questions to ask him, Kapiro? So I said, yes. What were the orders you received on the night of January 22nd, 1942? So he says, to look for terrorists. So I said, you mean like the four-year-old kid that was brought by his parents and the six-year-old? The judge disqualified the question. Okay, in any event, I was acquitted. That's the good news, okay? But when Hungary got the presidency of the European Union, which is on a rotating basis, January 2011, Kapiro was charged. First time a Hungarian Nazi war criminal is brought to justice in democratic Hungary since the fall of the Soviet Union. Hallelujah. Okay, he's charged. The trial begins in July, and the judge begins the trial by saying, no evidence that was from the original trial in 1943 and 44 can be admitted to this court. Wonderful. That's exactly how we knew everything about what Kapiro did. We knew that Kapiro was in charge of a section in the middle of town. We knew that six people were murdered by his men in the roundups themselves. And there was also, we also had evidence after the war that Kapiro, someone came to Kapiro with a truck full of arrested people. And instead of telling them to go to the theater where the committee could, in theory, release someone, he said, send them straight to the river. In other words, basically sending them to be murdered. So the information from the trial, we couldn't use. How about the evidence after the war? Ah, that was during the communists. They definitely tortured the witnesses. What's the proof? No proof. How does the judge end the trial? He says, Kapiro is not innocent, but the prosecution did not prove his guilt. Okay, so first of all, I can't even begin to tell you how upset I was. I invested 5 years in that case. Okay, we finally got him put on trial, and he was acquitted. Now, the government appealed. The Hungarian government appealed the sentence, and unfortunately, I have to say, I'm sorry to say, Kapiro died before the appeal could be heard. He was honored. He was given great honor by Jobbik. I don't know if you know Jobbik is. Jobbik is the extreme right Hungarian party, fascist party, pro-Iran, anti-Semitic, horrible people. They were there at his funeral praising him, and don't ask. So the one thing I could console myself was that it was the first case, only case, a Hungarian collaborator brought to justice. And there was one thing that happened that I really was totally floored. Throughout this whole process, we had the help of an evangelical church named the Faith Church. Faith Church is the fastest growing church in Hungary, very pro-Israel, very pro-Semitic, and actually quite wonderful people. And very often they used to send their kids, a lot of their younger people used to come to my trial as a show of support. And on the day that the trial opened in Budapest, they had about 30 of them standing with signs, "Thou shalt not murder, remember Novi Sad." And I tell you, I was broken up by this. It was just the most amazing thing. And the sad part is, no one came from the Jewish community. Now, the Jewish community helped me. They helped me with a lawyer, okay? But it wasn't as if Jews, you know, were coming by the hundreds or by the dozens to come to the trial to support the prosecution of Kapiro. Who came to support it? The people from Novi Sad, Jews from Novi Sad, and non-Jews from Novi Sad, and the people from the Faith Church. In any event, just maybe a couple of insights about this whole, about what? Ah, okay, Boydishow. We never found a single word document of any sort about Boydishow. I went to Miskolc, met with the survivors, no one remembered him. The Hungarians opened up a case against him, and they couldn't find any evidence, and we couldn't find any evidence. So it's not even clear if it's true. In any event, one of the things that, there are a couple of things. One thing is, to my mind, the most horrific aspect of the Shoah is that almost all the people that I dealt with, now you have to remember, I was born after World War II, okay? I couldn't catch Himmler. He committed suicide before I was born, okay? So the people I dealt with were middle level and lower level, okay? And almost every single one of them was a normative person before the war and was a normative person after the war. But of course, during the war, they did the most horrible things. And this, I think, was the power of the Nazis. The Nazis created the conditions, geopolitical conditions, to turn ostensibly normal people into mass murderers. So that's one thing. And By the way, I met some of the kids of these people who tried to convince me that their fathers were innocent. And it was a horrible experience, of course. But that's part of the job. The other thing is this. You know, all of us are naturally worried about anti-Semitism, and there's reason to be worried about anti-Semitism. But one of the rewarding things of my work over these last 38 years has been the absolutely wonderful people who helped me, many of them non-Jews, many of them without any compensation or any money or any payment or anything. They did it because it's the right thing to do. So we have to remember that. Remember that we have friends, not everybody, obviously, okay? And we're not in any way lessening our efforts to combat anti-Semitism, but it's important that we remember that also. Okay, thank you very much.
Wow. Yeah, of course. Anybody has questions for Dr. Zuroff, please?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think it could ever happen again?
Okay, first of all, okay, Ari, you repeat the questions, okay?
Sure. Yeah. The question that's being asked is, does the doctor think that it could happen again?
Doctor. Okay, listen, first, yeah, and a doctor. Okay, so first of all, unfortunately, because of technology, it's easier for it to happen again. This is the problem. And because it's happened once, it's easier to happen again. That doesn't mean it will happen again. Because on the other hand, I think there's... I think a fairly widespread perception, understanding of the danger of such things. In other words, the dangers of people like ISIS and others. In other words, a terrorist group today can get a hold of a nuclear device in theory, and then they can destroy God knows how many people. In other words, they don't have to be an army like the Wehrmacht and a strong army, you know, war machine like the Nazis. But that's one thing. But listen. The enormous work that's been invested in teaching about the Holocaust does have its rewards. In other words, there is an understanding of the danger of these people and the havoc they can create, but we have to be eternally vigilant. That's the reality. Yeah.
I have a question. So a lot of Lithuanians and Polish, Bolsheviks, communists, they're making up stuff about the freedom fighters that were fighting Russian occupation, and therefore all that they did was not part of it. How do you overcome that, and how do you deal with that?
Okay, great question. I'm happy you raised it. A lot of what we're doing today is the fight against what we call Holocaust distortion. Holocaust distortion means not to deny that the Shoah took place, but to do a couple of things, and all of this is happening in post-communist Eastern Europe. Okay, one, you have to remember that only in Eastern Europe did collaboration with the Nazis include participation in systematic mass murder. That was not the case outside of Eastern Europe. Now, outside, everywhere the Nazis were able to recruit local helpers, the ones outside of Eastern Europe helped the Nazis implement the initial stages of what we call the final solution. In other words, defining who's a Jew, robbing the Jews of their property, denying them a livelihood, rounding them up, arresting them, sending them to be murdered. That's accessory to murder. But the Vichy police did not murder the French Jews. The Dutch NSB did not murder the Dutch Jews, etc. Throughout Central and East, Central, Northern, and Southern Europe. They sent them to be murdered somewhere else by someone else. That somewhere else those places were in Eastern Europe, where the Nazis incorporated the Lithuanians, the Latvians, the Estonians, the Ukrainians, the Belarusians, and the Croatians did it on their own. So one thing they're trying to do is they're trying to hide their role in the Shoah. In other words, you go to Lithuania. In Lithuania, they talk nonstop about the Shoah. What's the Shoah? The Nazis, the Germans and Austrian Nazis, came to our country and murdered our Jews, Nebuch, a terrible tragedy. True, and if not, without the Germans and Austrians, there wouldn't have been a Shoah. But having said that, the Lithuanians, the Latvians, the Ukrainians, the Estonians, the Croatians were ones who carried out the murders. In Lithuania, there were less than 1,000 Germans during the Nazi occupation. And there are 227 mass Holocaust graves in Lithuania. 212,000 out of 220,000 Jews living in Lithuania were murdered during the Shoah. That's 96.4%. That's the highest percentage in a large Jewish community. But it wasn't only that. Thousands of Jews were brought from Germany, from Austria, from Czech Republic, from France, to Lithuania to be murdered in Lithuania by the Nazis and the Lithuanians. Lithuanian security police unit was sent to Belarus to murder Jews on October 6, 1941. They were sent to Belarus and they murdered 20,000 Jews in 15 different places. So until the Soviet Union crumbled, it was the communists who decided what would they would study, in other words, what the narrative of the Shoah would be. Okay? And the communists refused to acknowledge that the Jews were singled out for murder. And they didn't want to talk about the role of the locals in the murders. So it was only when the Soviet Union crumbled that the Lithuanians, Latvians, and all the others could learn the truth, teach the truth, write the truth. But the truth is horrible. They murdered their own people. And to make it even worse, some of their biggest heroes, they need heroes, these new countries, right? So who are their heroes? The ones who fought against the Soviets. Wonderful, that makes sense. Only one problem. Some of those people murdered Jews during the Shoah. So in theory, you would assume if someone murdered his fellow citizens, that they would disqualify them from being heroes. But not in Lithuania. And as a matter of fact, there was just a case about Jonas Noreika, who was one of the heads of the Lithuanian administration in northwestern Lithuania, in Šiauliai, in Žaga, etc., that area, in Telšiai. And he was responsible for the murder of about 15,000 Jews. In other words, he didn't pull the trigger, he organized everything. Now, Noreika, there's a plaque in the Lithuanian Academy of Sciences honoring him. There's a school named for him in the town that he was born. His name is carved on the facade of the Vilna District Court, which is also the Museum of Genocide, which talks only about the genocide of Lithuanians, not the real genocide. But they're changing the name now. In any event, so a Jew from California named Grant Gochin, he petitioned the Lithuanian government to get it taken off. There was a petition by intellectuals to the government to take off the plaque and end the glorification. And now they announced that that they're not going to do it because no one has the guts. Nope, there's going to be the elections for mayor in Vilna soon, in the next couple of months. So the mayor, that is the foreign minister, actually said they should remove the plaque. But the mayor is afraid to do it because they're afraid to lose the elections. And this is happening all over these countries. So one thing that we did, I personally did, was I wrote a book together with a Lithuanian author, a non-Jewish woman, who discovered that her family were involved in killing Jews during the Shoah. And she was absolutely traumatized by this fact, by this revelation. She sort of suspected it. But when they opened up the KGB files, she was able to read her grandfather's file. Okay, and her uncle, the husband of her aunt, was the chief of police in Panovich until the end of August 41, which was the critical period. He ran away to America, lived under a pseudonym, and he was never caught because he died before the OSI was set up. Okay? So we went on a mission of discovery to 40 places of mass murder in Lithuania and in Belarus. 35 in Lithuania, 5 in Belarus. And we went to see, are the places marked? Can you find them? Is there a monument? What does it say? We interviewed eyewitnesses. We went to local museums. We went to the local museum in Panovich. It's a fairly large city for Lithuanian standards. I asked them, is there anything here about the Jewish community? They go, no. I say, are you aware of the fact that millions of people all over the world know the name of your town? He goes, why? I said, you know the bakery opposite the bus station? That's the building of the Panovich Yeshiva. I explained to him what a yeshiva is and why it's famous. He was in total shock. I'll tell you another story. We tried to interview elderly people that we found along the way. By the way, we chose the places to go to based on our biographies. Okay, in other words, I'm named for my great uncle who was murdered together with his wife and his two kids, two boys in Vilna. And my grandparents on my mother's side, both of them were born in Lithuania. And I chose places that had meaning for me. And Ruta, my co-author, she chose places that were important for her, like Panovich, where her uncle was the police chief, like Kavaskas, where her grandfather made a list of communist activists Jews, in other words, who were murdered, etc. So I saw one day we were in this town near where my grandfather was born, and this woman is coming out of the grocery store, and she looked old enough to know to be alive during the Shoah. So I said to Ruth, no, go get a hold of her and ask her what's the story. Okay, so it turns out that she was one of two children, and she was friendly with a Jewish family, two girls they had, and she had a sister, and she was friendly with a Jewish family that also had two girls. Now, when all the trouble started, the decrees against the Jews, so they had a whole conversation in her house about trying to save, maybe they should save the younger Jewish girl who was her friend. Okay? So I said to Ruth, they ask her, you're probably afraid of the Germans. So she said, no. We easily could have hidden her from the Germans. That wasn't the problem. We were afraid of our neighbors. Okay, so the book, why was this book published? How could we get a book like this published in Lithuania, which was completely against all the narrative of the government? What happened was this, that Ruto was the most popular author in Lithuania. And her previous book, a book of advice to women at age 50, sold 50,000 copies in Lithuania, a country of less than 2.5 million people. Okay? So the publisher is putting pressure on Ruta to write another book. She goes, write a book about men. Write a telephone book. Everyone will buy your books. No problem. Anyway, so Ruta says, yeah, listen, I'll be happy to write a book about men, but first you'll publish the book I'm writing now. Ah, Ruta, you're already writing another book? How wonderful. What are you writing about? Oh, I'm writing about the Holocaust. What, are you nuts? Who's going to buy the book? So Ruta says, you want me to write another book? You're going to publish this book. So the publisher said, only on the condition you don't say a word about the subject of the book until the book comes out. Okay. So the book came out. We found the headquarters of the special unit that murdered 70,000 Jews at Ponar. It's an Italian restaurant in the heart of Vilna. Okay, Ruta made a clip about seven places of mass murder. And it started with a slide. 75 years ago, the Jews of Lithuania were murdered here. In other words, the Holocaust took place. Shows seven places, and it's in the winter, in the snow. Okay, and each slide showed the name of the place, the date of the murder, and the number of victims. Seven different places. And then another slide, 200,000 Lithuanian Jews were murdered during the Shoah with the help of Lithuanians. This was shown at every TV station. And the book became a runaway bestseller in total, contradiction to what anyone thought. But the government wasn't ready for this. So right away, Ruta is Putin's agent. She's working for the Russians or for the Jews, or maybe for both of them. And both of them are paying her to write a book. Okay? The head of national security goes on national television saying, this book is a threat to national security. What does it mean? Putin is going to invade Lithuania because of our book, which is absurd, of course. Okay? Anyway, a year ago, apropos your question, sorry, there's this case of this Adolfas Romanovskas, who was an anti-Soviet resistance fighter, and the parliament decided to devote this entire year to his memory. He was caught by the Soviets and executed. And they interviewed someone, I think it was the radio, interviewed Ruta, what she thought, and she had read his file in the KGB archives, and she knew all sorts of things about him that weren't so complimentary. So she said it's not such a good idea. The next day, her publisher announces that they are severing relations with her, and all her books are in the bookstores. 27,000 books were in the bookstores because the day before she had launched her autobiography, okay, will now be destroyed. Okay, so there was all sorts of protests from outside Lithuania about destroying the books. In the end, she got back the books. She can't sell them. Because no one wants to be able to sell for her. So they're sitting in a garage in Vilna, and she and the first head of state of Lithuania, Landsbergis, wrote an op-ed in the most important internet portal, basically telling her, Miss Venegaita, now that you've betrayed the country, why don't you go into the forest and commit suicide? So she was really worried, so she's now in Israel, okay? Where she feels obviously much, much safer, okay, and much more protected. But the books haven't been sold. And in the meantime, the book came out in Lithuanian, sold 18,000 copies until they were taken off the shelves. It came out in Polish, in Russian in Hebrew, but we still don't have a publisher in English. It's coming out in Swedish next year also. So we're still looking for a publisher in English, and hopefully we'll get one. Anyone have any ideas for us? We're open to listening to ideas or support. And the fight goes on. The fight goes on everywhere, in Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia and Ukraine. Ukraine is now the worst, by the way. Because of the Crimea, because of the annexation of Crimea by Russia, because of the insurgency in eastern Ukraine, no one's willing to say a word of criticism to the Ukrainians. Yeah. Okay, first of all, I don't agree with the thesis, okay? Argentina didn't slide into authoritarianism because they admitted Nazi war criminals. That was one of many problems, flaws with Argentina under Perón, and that's why it happened. But what's the second part of your question about the states?
Going off that thesis, in countries you've experienced more problems in, because of that you talk about one part of a larger issue with it. Do you worry with recent resurgence of right-wing populism around the world that we could see something similar happen in Eastern Europe and other liberal democracies that adopted it after the 90s?
Okay, first of all, I don't think we're at that point. This is not 1939, okay? There's no question that the failure to tell the truth about the Holocaust is part of something much larger. And what we call, what Viktor Orban calls the Prime Minister of Hungary, these illiberal democracies. So this is definitely a trend, and this is something of concern. I have to tell you, though, one of the ironies of this situation is, and it's the first time in Jewish history, in the history of the Jewish people, that you have a situation where countries love Israel and they hate Jews. Countries like Hungary, like Lithuania, like Latvia, they have wonderful relations with Israel because it suits them, because they need Israel. Israel has a lot to offer them. Israel, they very much admire Israel as a small country in a difficult environment, which is able to not only to survive, but to flourish. So, and they want to learn from Israel. But they're anti-Semitic, basically. And the part of our problem is that the state of Israel, and I say this with an enormous pain, I'm an Israeli by choice, okay? You can tell from my New York accent. I wasn't born in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem, okay? But I'm in Israel 48 years, okay? Israel is my country, not America, okay? But Israel, for a variety of reasons, connected to defense, intelligence, security, politics, has been very reluctant to fight against these phenomena in Eastern Europe. Historical questions.
Politics. Yeah. Let's do one more question, and then we'll formally close it.
Up to you. Sure, you're the balabayit. Okay, yeah. No, they succeeded.
Right, they succeeded.
But there were only about 17 of them.
Right, no, I understand. I'm not even comparing. Yeah. But the question is, why wasn't, it seems like there's this gap when, 48, 50.
Very simple. One of the easiest way to explain why countries don't want to prosecute Nazi war criminals is to compare a serial killer to a 90-year-old Nazi. In other words, if a serial killer were on the loose here in Atlanta or anywhere nearby, the police would be doing everything possible to catch that person and put them away, put them in jail, right? Because the likelihood is that a serial killer will strike again. That's the nature of serial killers. What are the chances of a 90-year-old Nazi killing anybody? Zero. In the 50s, there were quite a bit, far more efforts and attempts to bring people to justice. In the 40s, after the war, from 45 on, thousands and thousands and thousands of trials. You just don't know about it. They're long forgotten. And throughout all of Europe, not, and especially in the areas under the communists. But listen, it's a question of the contemporary enemy and the previous enemy. In other words, the Arabs were considered, the Arab terror was a problem from, in other words, before 72 and continued to be a problem. So the goal of sending a message to Fatah and all the others, Jibril, et cetera, was very important. And as opposed to these people. But listen, one of the things I learned that I think this is very important to understand. There was no way on earth for conventional justice to be complete justice. It was absolutely impossible. In other words, the number of people who were involved in the crimes of the Shoah was so great that it was impossible to bring them to justice. And not only that, they also were hindered. And I'll give you a perfect example. At Nuremberg, new categories of criminality were created. Crimes against humanity, crimes against peace, okay? The Germans refused to use those categories, which were a far better reflection of the Shoah. In other words, those categories helped convict people who there might have been some legal difficulty to convict them. So in Nuremberg, they were used, and they were used successfully. Okay, the German legal system, West Germany assumed responsibility for the courts in 1949 when the Allied occupation of Germany ended. Okay, and they refused to use those categories because they said it's ex post facto. Now, what that means is that the law was passed after the crime was committed. But it didn't bother people in Nuremberg, and they used it and they applied it with great success. In Germany, they refused to do it, so the Nazi war criminals were tried under a statute against murder that was written in 1871 in Prussia. So is it surprising that there were problems prosecuting Nazi war criminals? They tried to limit the number. But that's true everywhere. I'll give you an example. I was twice invited to Rwanda, okay, to help the government in terms of trying to find the people responsible for the genocide. When I came down there, I came there a year after the genocide ended in 1994. I came in 95, okay? They already had 100,000 suspects in jail. Almost all the judges had been murdered during the genocide. Almost all the courtrooms had been destroyed. How on earth are they ever going to be able to try these people? And ultimately, what happened in Rwanda was, and in the beginning, by the way, there was a big debate over what method to use. And there were people, say, from South Africa and from countries in Central America who tried to convince the Rwandans not to opt for criminal justice, to opt for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So just as an explanation, you know that in South Africa, they instituted the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, whereby people could admit the crimes, and then if they were sincerely, you know, regretting, et cetera, like this, they wouldn't be punished as in a criminal trial, and they were spared punishment, basically. Okay? Now, this is all the work of Desmond Tutu, and it was all based on Christian forgiveness. So, and when we were in Rwanda, I emphasized to them, and they agreed with me, the Rwandans agreed with me, that apartheid is not genocide. There's an enormous difference between genocide and apartheid. One is discrimination, the other one is mass murder. So the Rwandans rejected the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But ultimately, what happened in Rwanda was they had to go over to something called Gacaca. Gacaca is like a traditional African method, which is very similar to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And the problem in Rwanda was, and this we, the Jews, didn't have to suffer. In Rwanda, the killers and their families, the victims, continued to live in the same places. In other words, these people used to see each other every day.